this is a, I listed this book by Mahan, Condensed Matter in a Nutshell, as the primary reference. Well, doesn't cover literally everything I will be talking about, but it covers a lot. So this is a relatively modern textbook on solid state / condensed matter, and it's pretty readable. It's not very formal. It's readable. But if you want to read something more in depth, for example, if you've known the subject already, you can go to, let's say, Ashraf Merman. Yes. I think they have it in the library. But the only problem is a fairly old textbook, and some of the things I will be talking about later are actually younger than this book. So I'll give you more reference if I get there. Okay, so let me comment briefly a little bit about the power of Bloch theorem, right? So what does it really buy you? What does it buy you is that now we know how to label the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. Before, okay, some fermion moving some crazy periodic lattice potential, it looks like a mess, but now essentially you label everything with two indices. One is the index of the band, which is a discrete number, right? It's 1, 2, 3. Sorry, am I writing a very... Right. The other thing is a continuous momentum, or sometimes called lattice momentum, that lives on a circle.
Oh, right. Reasonable.
I'm taking the 1D example, but works in all the higher dimensions, right? So this is continuous. And the band index in general is discrete. So for example, if I have two bands, in general, I expect within the same band, there's some notion of continuity, either with the Bloch wave function or with the energy. For example, this is my 2 pi over 8. So I expect the dispersion to look something like this, right? But if I have two bands, in general I expect this, because at the same momentum, this one and this one, they're not related by anything. So they in general they have a finite energy difference generically. Okay? And they can do pretty funny thing here. They can do like this. So if the shape looks like this, then if your chemical potential is here, then you have both bands partially filled. That's entirely possible. But another thing that you may wonder, you can wonder whether this can happen, right? You can ask, could it ever be possible that two bands intersect in the sense that at some momentum k, the two bands have exactly the same energy? If you just draw it casually, it seems like that's possible. Well, it's possible, but it's not going to be generic. So generically, you don't expect this, because if this ever happens, then you can say, I can turn on a tiny perturbation in my Hamiltonian, essentially mix these two states. Because now these two states, they have the same energy, the same momentum. So I can turn on a Hamiltonian term. You know, that's essentially with an off-diagonal matrix element between these two states. Okay? So once you have that, what happened is that this figure will turn into this figure. Essentially, you reopen a gap between the two, and then you rename what you mean by banding this. So now this thing is called band one. I should draw it more clearly. And this thing is called the lower band. Okay. So generically, you don't expect two bands to really touch each other, right? Unless there's some reason. One common reason is there might be some symmetry that forbids you to open up such an off-diagonal matrix element in your Hamiltonian, right? And then you will have generic band touching. that's what we are going to see today. So today I'm going to talk about an example of graphene. It's also a nice way to illustrate to you how Bloch theorem actually works in practice. And to illustrate to you the power of symmetries. So, so yesterday I only talked about the symmetries of the lattice, discrete lattice translation. That alone already leads to Bloch theorem, which is an incredibly useful statement. So today we're going to look at more symmetries and get even more powerful statements. Okay. So graphene. Well, you've probably heard of at least the word. It's essentially a single layer of graphite. So carbons form a two-dimensional layer of honeycomb lattice. So it's a bunch of hexagons. Right. Well, one thing is for the entire course, you have to tolerate my terrible drawing, but you get the idea. So at each site, there is a carbon atom. And there are four electrons in the outer shell of the carbon. It turns out three of them form pretty strong sigma bonds with the nearby carbon. So it's at reasonably low temperature, for example, room temperature, they are pretty dead. It's very hard to excite them. So the only thing that's alive is one remaining electron on each carbon.
Okay.
Sometimes also called the pi bond. Okay. So what happens? So you essentially you get one electron orbit per per site. But you have two spins, right? So so there are really two orbits, but you have one electron, so it's half filled. Right. So you have one electron, but two spin. So it's half. Right. So the meaning C I up C up plus C is one on each side. And let's assume that spin rotation symmetry is unbroken, which is pretty much true for graphene. That means these two numbers should be the same. And then that means this guy should be 1/2.
Okay.
And from now on, I'll drop the spin index. And I'll treat it as if there's no spin and this is at half filling. Okay. But even before we talk about filling, you can ask what do I expect generically here? Okay. So what is this lattice? Okay. So if I look at translation symmetry, right, what translation symmetry do I have? Well, I can translate by this amount. Let me call this A1. So that's a symmetry. Okay. I can also translate here. Let me call it by A2. That's obviously another symmetry. But I can't translate this much, right? The lattice looks different. So that's not a symmetry. Right. So in fact, this, in terms of translation, almost like, you know, it's almost like a triangle lattice. So the unit cell, I have a choice, but this is obviously a convenient choice. So each unit cell has two atoms, actually. Right. So if you like, you can think of the honeycomb as a stack of two triangle ladders, right? So this one, let me call it A, or the A atom, they form a triangle lattice. And then all the B atom also forms triangle lattice. So we call them sublattices. So each unit cell has one A atom and one B atom, and then you have the translation symmetry.
Can you explain why I can translate between A and B atoms again?
Oh, if I translate, A goes to B, but B goes to here.
Okay.
But there's nothing there.
Oh, I can send B to the other, like diagonal, like to from B to A, like there to the other A.
No, but that's not a translation, right? You have to do some rotation to do that. I mean, if I do translation means everything moves by the same vector, right? So if A moves to B, B has to move to here.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. You're talking about rotation symmetry, which will be important later, but let's not worry about it now. Yeah. So two orbits per unit cell, which means if I solve the band structure, in general, I expect two bands. Okay. And as I said, if I have two bands in general, okay, it's a two-dimensional system, but if I just make a cut, let's say, just schematically, in general, I expect something like this. As I said, you don't, you know, if you ever want these two bands to touch each other at some point, you need some special reason.
Sorry, why we expect two bands? Is it that because we have two kinds of particles?
Yeah, essentially, if I label each unit cell, then there's CA at unit cell I and CB at unit cell I. Right, so A and B, you know, essentially the number of bands you get is equal to the number of orbits you have on in each unit cell. So in this case, two. You'll see explicitly later when I actually solve the domain. Yes.
I think I see what you mean, but let's say that you have a one-dimensional line of sides.
Yes.
You can arbitrarily choose any unit cell with
yes.
more than one side.
Yes.
It will still be a lattice.
Yes.
Translation.
Yes. But that one you are then. You are essentially looking at a subgroup of the full symmetry, right? So you are not utilizing the full power of the symmetry. So here, but here it's somewhat different. So here, you know, this choice of lattice, or it doesn't matter, you can choose this one or that one, they give you the full translation.
Yeah, I understand why it's different, because you cannot go any smaller than
yes,
that.
Yes,
but,
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. The property of the lattice is that there is a small there is a minimum basis.
Okay.
Right. You can't go any smaller than that.
Now that I sort of interrupted already, I have another question with the beginning of what you said, that we have four electrons in outer shells, but are we considering just one?
Oh yeah. Because the other three, they form very strong sigma bonds.
Oh, so we're considering only the p bonds.
We're only considering the pi bonds.
The pi bonds.
Yeah, because the sigma bonds, you need gigantic energy to excite them. So
right.
At reasonable temperatures.
Okay, so three electrons in sigma bonds, I'm going to start in the one in the pi bond.
Yes.
Gotcha.
Okay, so I think that's the only chemistry I will ever mention in this class. yeah, so generically we expect the band structure to look like this. So if I'm at half filling, so I should expect to occupy the lower band and let the upper band empty. So you say, okay, maybe I get an insulator.
Okay.
Turns out that's not true for graphene. And the reason is you have more symmetries than just lattice translation. You have rotation and even time reversal and so on. So that protects you from having an insulator. So let's see that explicitly. Okay. So let's make a tight binding model of this, which is reasonably accurate for graphene, actually. So essentially, on every orbit, I say I have one. On every site, I have one orbit, and let me label that as. So let me first of all label the sites as n1 a1 plus n2 a2. Sorry, that's the unit cells. Okay. For example, I can take my reference point here, and then this is a lattice point. And then I can make any integer combinations of A1, A2, and then I will always land on an A point. Okay. By the way, that's known as a Bravais lattice. That's the basic lattice structure, and the rest will be sublattice or inter-unit cell structure. Okay, so now essentially on every unit cell, which is labeled by this two-dimensional integer vector n, I have two orbits, A and B. Okay, A means the electron living here, B means the electron living. Okay. That's clear. So now let me just write down the Hamiltonian. Yes.
The small a vector, you're defining that as a translation to the same type of
yes.
terms, like a to a or
yes.
b to b?
Yes. Yeah, that's the only symmetry I have. That's the only translation symmetry I have. Yeah. So the Hamiltonian, let me, well, okay. At a very basic level, let me just make a nearest neighbor type binding. So when I write ij, I mean two sides. Okay, not using this notation yet. I'll be using it later. But ij means just two sides in general that are in nearest neighbor. So a to b, b to the nearest a, and so on. So every side has three nearest neighbors. This guy can go to this, this, this. Ci j plus the Hermitian conjugate. Okay. So it's just nearest neighbor hop, the simplest possible type binding model on this lattice. But now if I use this notation, right, this becomes something like this. So let me explain the notation later, actually, A, B. A, B, B, A. So what am I doing? I'm just saying that this, you can think of it as three kinds of terms. One is I have a hopping between these two. That's within unit cell, right? So I'm not moving between unit cell. That's, so that's this. So n, the n index doesn't change. It's just the a, b index that I'm hopping. Right? Also, I have this kind of term, or this. So that's hopping between B side and A side, but in a different unit cell, in a nearby unit cell. And likewise, I have this term, which is hopping between A side and B side, but again, in a different direction. Okay. So this M vector plus this number and minus those numbers, they refer to that. And yes.
Can you explain it again, please?
Yes. So actually, you'll be doing this this afternoon in your tutorial, but let me still explain it. The meaning is this kind of term only hops within the unit cell, but this type and this type hops in between different unit cells, because this, I'm going from this unit cell to this unit cell, which I should view it as this unit cell plus A2, defined here. And A2 in my M vector notation is 0, 1.
How are you defining the unit cell? It's not very clear.
Like, yeah, you have a choice. So what you do is you make sure that you choose it so that once you have your unit cell, you just keep doing translations operation, and then you fill the entire lattice. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So for example, you say if I just choose this as my unit cell, then you keep doing translation, you get all the A sites. You get none of the B sites. Yeah, so that's the criteria. Anyway, you'll see, you'll go through this in more detail in your tutorial. So to make sure you actually know, understand it, okay? But it's some type binding Hamiltonian. Then how do you, okay, you have this Hamiltonian, how do you solve it? Well, Bloch theorem tells you that basically you just blindly do Fourier transform. You're guaranteed to be able to solve it. That's the power of Bloch theorem. Okay. So what you do is essentially, let me do the inverse Fourier transform for you. So it doesn't be, sorry. The sublattice structure, let me call it little, am I calling it little a? Yeah, let me call it little a, that can be either a or b, right? So n1, n2 are the, you know, if you want to put it on a finite system with a periodic boundary condition, n1, n2 are the length in the two directions. Yeah, maybe I shouldn't use A. Let me use S to label sublattice. So that's a Fourier transform. Okay. And of course you can ask, okay, well, what's the domain of K? Well, again, the rule is always that at the end of the day, only this phase factor is meaningful. So whenever two K differ by an amount that, you know, makes no difference on the phase factor, they should be considered the same. So that means K is equivalent to K plus some G vector, which is, as I told you, it's known as the reciprocal vector. And okay, you can figure out what condition the G should satisfy. Well, essentially you want something like G, well, there are two G's, G1 and G2, because I'm in two dimension. Essentially, I want GI inner product with AJ to be 2 pi delta IJ. Okay, where A1, A2 are the generating vectors of my private slots. Okay. And you just plug in those two vectors and try to solve this. Right? Well, the solution in general in two dimension, I actually showed you how it looks like in three dimension, but in two dimension it looks something like this. J, AJ cross Z over A1 cross A2. Okay. So you can see that if I plug this expression into this, it solves this equation. So you can then now plug in those A1, A2 and see what it looks like. Well, it looks like this. G2 is in this direction with some length. G1 is in this direction. So there's a 120 degree. By the way, all those angles are 120. It's the maximally symmetric part. Right. Okay. So then what does the Brillouin zone look like? Right. As I said, it's a unit cell of the lattice spanned by this G1, G2. Right. So there is a way to construct such a unit cell, given the two generating vectors. The way is this. So I take the middle point of this G2, draw a line perpendicular to it, take a middle point of G1, this two should have the same length. Draw a point here. And now I also remember that G1 plus G2 is also a legitimate reciprocal vector. Right? So this is G1 plus G2. So I also take the middle point and draw a line perpendicular to it. And then I look at the intersection of everything like this. Eventually I get a hexagon. Yeah, that's a terrible drawing. So let me redraw it. I get a hexagon like this, and then twice of this is my G2, and twice of this is my G1. Yeah, that looks better. Okay. So why does this work, you say? Well, for example, you can see that the difference between this point and this point, that's precisely G2. Right, because by construction, because this is the middle point,
G2.
And essentially this edge is identified with this edge because two momentum connected by a reciprocal lattice vector should be considered identical. And likewise, this edge is identified with this edge, and this edge, this edge. Okay. And you can check that within this zone, there are all the, you know, any two vector within this zone, their difference is smaller than just g1, g2. Right, so you can't, yes?
Could you explain what all the subscripts on the seeds are again?
Sorry?
Could you explain what all the subscripts are for the seeds? And
yeah, so, sorry. Right, so the n hat, the n vector there is labeling the unit cell. The a and b are labeling within that unit cell whether I'm sitting on a side or b side. Right. So this n is a vector. It's an integer vector with two numbers, n1 and n2. So this is just n1 equal to 1 and n2 equal to -1.
Yeah, I have a question.
Yes.
Like, what are the operators for different spins?
Yeah, so sorry. So this means electron creation operator of spin half spin up state, right? And this is for spin down state. Right? You have the electron has spin half, so you expect two states there. And that's pretty much all I can say.
But I think maybe they mean like in the. Can we see those somehow in the?
Sorry. Yeah. So, yeah. Let's say, for this purpose, think of all this as spin up, right? Because spin down will have exactly the same thing, except you replace all the C up by C down. So, for this because there's a symmetry between up and down, it doesn't. They don't. It's just two copies. Yes.
The hopping cannot change the spin. Like,
I'm assuming that doesn't happen.
Okay.
So that will happen if you have something like spin orbit coupling. So I'm assuming that doesn't exist here.
Yes.
Oh, in fact, if you start to think about spin orbit coupling in graphene, you end up discovering topological insulator, which is a good thing. But let's not do that. Okay. Okay, so this is your Brillouin zone, and that's your Fourier transform.
Sorry.
Yes.
So you have G1 and G2, and they're off by 120 degrees.
Yes.
But I don't see out of that how you get the directly across momentum to be similar.
Sorry. So because by construction, this is a half middle point of G1.
Yeah.
And this is a middle point of minus G1.
Okay.
So they differ by G1.
Yeah.
And in fact, if I have a real space lattice, that's also how you can construct a unit cell, build the entire thing. All right, so now I have my Fourier transform defined. The rest is just plug it into the Hamiltonian and see what it looks like. Okay. And again, you'll go through all this again this afternoon. It's a good exercise. And what you end up finding is that, okay, let me also define CK as CK sublattice A and CK sublattice B. So it's a two-dimensional vector, right, if you like. So once you define that, the Hamiltonian becomes this. Remember, now this is a two-dimensional vector. So in general, when I write down an expression like this, I expect a 2x2 matrix here. Okay. And then you see that the diagonal part is 0. That's simple. That's simply because in the Hamiltonian, I have only A to B hopping. There's no A to A hopping. So the diagonal part is 0. And now what does the off-diagonal part look like? Actually, I need a longer space. Okay. The off-diagonal part looks like this. 1 plus e to the I k dot a2 plus e to the I k dot a2 minus a1. Zero and the complex conjugate.
Sorry, I cannot see the index.
Sorry?
I cannot see the
indices.
Small indices in there.
K. Sorry.
So A2.
No, A2. Oh, sorry. A2 minus A1. Yeah. So that's what you end up getting. Now you just diagonalize this Hamiltonian, essentially, right? So whenever you have some Hamiltonian like 0, 0, a star, you know how to diagonalize that. And you can play with it. But what you end up getting is that the eigenvalue is always plus minus mod A. That's the two eigenvalues. So essentially, that's indeed consistent with what I said before on general ground. Right? You expect two bands. So at each momentum k, you have two states, and then you diagonalize it, you get two eigenstates with this amount of energy. And in general, they differ. They differ by 2a. Okay, so there is a gap in general between the two bands, unless this number happens to be exactly zero. Right? And now you just stare at this number. You realize it's the sum of three phases with modulo 1. So they can only be zero if it's 1 plus e to the I 2 pi over 3 plus e to the minus I 2 pi over 3. Essentially, this is zero only if it's the summation of these three vectors.
Is that A2 and A1 in the exponential? I'm sorry, I cannot.
Yeah. Sorry. Let me write it bigger. 1 plus e to the I.
Thank you.
K dot A2. Yeah. Always remind me if I end up writing in tiny font. Let me see what I do. What do I have? A2 minus A1. Better? Okay. So essentially, the energy is zero if this k dot a2 equal to minus k dot a2 minus a1 equal to 2 pi over 3, or plus minus 2 pi over 3, mod 2 pi, of course. Now you actually, it's just an algebraic equation. Now you actually stare at that, and then you realize that what happens is there are two points at the zone corner. Let me call it capital K and minus capital K. Sometimes it's also called K prime. These are the only points within the Brillouin zone that satisfy that. Okay. It turns out these points also do, but they're not new additional points because this point is identical to this. They are related by the reciprocal lattice vector G1. So this is also K. Likewise, this is also K. And this is minus, this is K prime, this is K prime, this is K prime. Okay. So what you end up getting is it's almost like that, except the two bands have the same energy, which is exactly zero, at precisely these two special momentum points, K and K prime. And now another magic that's Well, essentially, if I, let's say, look at the dispersion, let's say, along this cut, what I find is that the dispersion looks like this. All right, so away from, this is k prime, this is k. So away from these 2 points, everything has a gap. But then near the 2 points, I get this kind of touching. Okay. So this, okay, they look, these points look special enough that that's, you know, it's worth studying in a little bit more detail. So let's actually look at what happens if I'm close, but not exactly at this k and k prime. Okay. So now consider the momentum that's equal to k, let's say, plus minus k, plus a delta, plus a little bit. Okay. Now you can put in this expression into this Hamiltonian and see what it looks like. Right? What you find is that the Hamiltonian to leading order in delta k becomes something like this. 0, 0, and plus minus delta k x plus I, sorry, I think minus I delta k y plus minus delta kx plus I delta ky. C. Ck. All right? Let me call delta k. I know. Well, what does that mean? Well, if you diagonalize it, the energy looks like this. Delta k squared plus delta k y squared. So that's just saying it's this thing. Yeah, it's just the mod squared. It's just the mod. So what does that dispersion look like? Well, it looks like a cone. And if you actually try to plot it in 2D, it looks like a cone like this. Okay. And that's known as a Dirac cone. It's literally what you get for the dispersion of a massless Dirac equation in two dimensions. And you can actually even rewrite this that make it look like a Dirac Hamiltonian. And let me just take this matrix. Forget about C and C there for now. So this you can rewrite it as a Dirac momentum. Screw it. Let me call this V D because it's gonna be my essentially velocity times delta kx. Well, okay, sorry. Let me also define the notion of valley, which is define valley index plus minus for modes near the two points. And I call the Pauli matrices acting on this valley index tau. Then the Hamiltonian looks like this. Right. So let me read it for you. So tau z means if it's valley plus, meaning I'm near momentum plus k, then there's a plus sign. And if it's minus, meaning I'm near the valley, the momentum minus k, then there's a minus sign. So that's this plus minus. Okay? And sigma x just means I'm having a delta x kx here, delta x kx here. That's a Pauli sigma x, right? And likewise, sigma y means that I have a minus I here and plus I here.
What is B?
Sorry?
What is B?
Yeah. VD, I define this.
Right.
Yeah.
So tau is the valley index?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. This acts on valley.
So what's the subscript of the VD?
Oh yeah. D. It stands for Dirac.
Okay.
But it's just a velocity. Okay, so this really looks like Dirac Hamiltonian. You can make it even more similar by doing this. So now let's consider the fermion creation annihilation operator in real space, but a continuum version of that. By that I mean this. So in real space defined as essentially some kind of inverse Fourier transform, but of the Bloch states only near k and minus k, okay, not the entire not the Bloch state over the entire Brillouin law. So what I mean is to the I k x c k. Minus k plus k. And I define it, the rule of the Fourier transform is that the k involved are much smaller than a cutoff scale, where this gamma is much smaller than, let's say, the size of the Brillouin. Okay. Essentially, I'm saying you take the inverse Fourier transform of Bloch states only near k and k prime. So you take Fourier transform.
Can you elaborate more on why you say it's almost Dirac? Because at the beginning we assume no relativistic.
Yeah, correct.
So
correct.
But the group was almost like Lorenzo. You just like the
yes.
Stage
vectorization. Yes. 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 Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Yes. So the reason is this. So in this case, what looks like Lorentz symmetry, we call it it's emergent. It's not there on the lattice, but if you only care about energy near zero, for example,
mm-hmm.
and wavelength much longer than the lattice constant. And then essentially the modes you care about can be summarized in this thing, because you only care about modes here. And then the effective description of this guy, actually that's what I'm going to write down. In terms of psi, the Hamiltonian essentially looks like Vd times psi dagger, tau z sigma x I partial x plus sigma y I partial y. So this is literally the Dirac equation in quantum field theory. Okay. So this is a to leading order description. Right? If I'm being honest, there are high order terms. There are some, you know, if I go to higher enough momentum or energy, there will be all sorts of additional terms, partial x squared or you know, eventually I start to see that my momentum is actually periodic, defined periodically, it's not a real momentum and all that. But as long as I stay at long wavelength and low energy, here low energy meaning close to zero, I don't care about any of that. And this distribution is as good as anything else. Okay. And in fact, this is how many condensed matter physicists would prefer to think about quantum field theory in general. Right. So you can say that this gives you a UV regularization or UV completion or a lattice regularization, it comes with many names, of a quantum field theory. Right. So at some limit, like low energy, long wavelength, I get something that looks like a QFT. But deep down, I know that it's just an ordinary quantum mechanical system, right, with finite Hilbert space dimension. Per volume. So that's always nice, right? Because if you work with QFT alone, you have to constantly worry about whether the stuff you're talking about are well-defined, right? But this way, at least on the lattice, it's always well-defined.
So the fact that the bands are touching at those particular points, I would guess that some sort of Lau condition or something?
Yeah. Well, sorry, what do you mean by Lau condition?
Brow,
Bragg,
diffraction condition of some sort.
Is it? It's
not
directly related, I would say. Yeah, I'm not sure if it's directly related.
So, like, what is the physical reason that is happening? And like, why do we get like massless fermion?
Yeah, well, actually, I am going to, to some extent, get there. But next, essentially, because symmetry requires you.
So, I know this is a theoretical class, but how would you exploit this experimentally?
Yeah, great. So you can say how. This is pretty well. I mean, this kind of Dirac fermion, they are pretty well established experimentally. You can ask how, right? There are many signatures you can measure, but I think the most convincing one comes from measuring the what's known as quantum Hall effect. Quantum Hall effect.
Okay.
For example, you shoot a perpendicular magnetic field.
Yeah.
This Dirac fermions respond in a peculiar way, and that's been seen.
Okay.
You can also measure a bunch of other things. For example, you may see that at some tutor, we don't know. But for example, if you measure specific heat, this thing goes as T squared. If I have a Fermi C, the specific heat, if you may remember from your standard class, it's linear in T at low energy. This thing is T squared. If it's a boring insulator, it's exponentially small in 1 over gap over T.
I see.
Right. So there are all sorts of signatures that people can measure.
Can you simulate the Dirac equation using graphene systems?
Yeah, people do that.
Yeah?
Yeah. In fact, lattice gauge theory people prefer to do it slightly differently, not exactly this lattice.
Right.
But there are many lattice systems where you can realize a Dirac fermion at low energy. Yeah, I think I should fulfill my promise of 5 minute break. So let's resume in 5 minutes. Potential. Okay. So I look at energy minus mu. In this case, chemical potential is zero. It happens to be so. I get a dispersion like this. I look at one-dimensional cut. And because I'm at half filling, so I should, this figure, tells you that I should just fill all the energy, all the modes with energy below zero, and leave all the energy level above zero empty. So the chemical potential happened to be sitting exactly at the Dirac. Yes.
Can you explain a bit more, like what you mean by cuts and whatnot? I have no idea what you're saying.
Oh, that's just because it's too hard for me to draw 3D.
Okay.
Right. So this cut, for example, if I draw the Brillouin zone, right, there are many ways to do it. For example, I'm saying, cut along this line. I measure K in this, literally this line.
Okay.
Fix the momentum component in the perpendicular direction. I'll use that word quite often later in the course. Yeah, it's good. You know what I'm talking about. Right, but in general, you expect. Yeah, let me not draw 3D. You can actually just Google image search graphene band structure or graphene Dirac fermion. You'll see the 3D plot. It's actually quite clear. Okay, so now let me actually ask the physical questions. The physical question is, okay, I told you that you get a Dirac fermion at low energy and long wavelength in graphene. And the first question you should ask me is, why should I buy that at all? Because I've only solved for you the simplest possible type binding model, literally only nearest neighbor Hopkin. You say, in practice, graphene is not going to be literally described by a type nearest neighbor type binding model. you can have, for example, second neighbor hopping. I can have hopping from A site to A site. Right? I can have third neighbor hopping. I can have all sorts of things. So once I add those things in, why do I expect to keep a special feature like this? Why can't I add a perturbation and then make the thing go away like this? That's a legitimate question. Yes.
Well, I guess because the lattice is somehow symmetric along those momentum k prime.
Sorry. I'll tell you that. Yeah. So this, if I have translation symmetry alone, this is certainly not forbidden. Right. But turns out the other symmetries are forbidden. This. But let's. Before doing that, let's ask what kind of terms will do the job of opening a gap for my Dirac fermion? Well, that's just a question of Dirac equation. You see that Hamiltonian, then any mass, any term that will give you a mass, if you remember from your QFT class, are matrices that anti-commute with both these two matrices. Okay? These are essentially your gamma matrices, essentially. So terms like mass terms. So if I use that basis, they look like, for example, tau x or y, sigma x, sigma z, or tau z, sigma z. You can count all the Pauli matrices and see that these are the only possibilities. Okay. So why can't I just add them to my Hamiltonian? So for that, let's analyze the symmetries of the problem. Well, there are lots of, this lattice comes with many symmetries. So let's do it one by one. So the first is translation. We know what translation does. That's Bloch theorem. So let me just remind you that, for example, translation by A1 sends, if I write it in the component of valley component, this plus minus are valley. So they sit near the k and minus k. What happens is essentially k a1 right. Or you say this psi may not be sitting exactly at the momentum k prime, but close. So that's enough for you to figure out just by Bloch theorem that they should get these phase factors under translation.
Someone just asked if you could explain that graph again. Which parts are the bands?
Oh. Sorry. These are the two bands I'm talking about, right? So for the nearest neighbor type binding model, what I get is a dispersion like this. So this curve I call the upper band. This one is the lower band. So the two touches at this point that I call Dirac. Let me know if that's still not clear.
Can you show in more detail that why we have the opposite phase sign in the
this one?
5 plus 5 minus, yeah.
This one?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Because that's the definition, right? By writing down 5 plus, I'm saying these are modes near the momentum k. 5 minus are modes near the momentum minus k, right? Right there.
Yes.
So Bloch theorem tells you under translation, you get a phase factor e to the I k dot a.
I see.
And if you're near the opposite momentum, you get the opposite. And by the value of k, you can now plug in the number. You get something like e to the minus I 2 pi over 3 tau z psi. Tau z simply means you get the opposite phase, right? If it's upper, if it's plus, you get this phase. If it's minus, you get the opposite. Yes?
Could you explain the mass term again?
Oh, yeah, okay. Sorry. So for example, you can take one of this. Let's say take this one. And add that to that term. Right. So what does the Hamiltonian look like? Well, the Hamiltonian looks like this. I mean, if you in real space, it looks like this. But in momentum space, it looks like this. Plus, let's say a mass times sigma z. Now you try to diagonize this. Now the thing is, all these three matrices anti-commutes. You have tau z, sigma x, sigma y, sigma z. They all anti-commute. So if you diagonize that, the eigenvalue is going to be plus minus the sum of the square of each term, right? Because if you just sum this entire matrix, you get the square of each term. Yes.
Are these like plus minus modes related to Weyl spinners at all? Because we saw them in QFT, they kind of have a similar construction.
So say it again. Are these plus minus what?
Modes related to the Weyl spinners.
Yes.
Are they the Weyl spinners?
No, because we're in 2+1 dimension. There's no chirality. So in 2+1D, it happens that Weyl is pretty much Dirac. So, yeah. Because, well, you can say that if I only look at one component, phi plus, it's a two component vector because I have the AB sublattice index. That sounds like a Weyl. Right, so plus minus almost sounds like Weyl components, except that notion is not extremely well defined. Yeah, in odd space time dimension, Weyl and Dirac are not clearly the same.
So now I'm confused. Is phi plus and minus? Do we have four spinner in the system?
No, the phi. Each one has two index. That's the AB sublattice index.
Yeah.
So this is additional index coming from the K minus K.
Right, and in 2D, a Dirac spinner has also two indices.
Yes.
Okay.
Well,
I think
at that point it becomes a notation, but most people would use the notation. Well, a lot of people use the notation that it's two component.
Sir, can you say more to the details why we don't have the chirality in 2+1D? Is that five plus and five minus are related in some?
Well, the thing is if you're in three space time dimension, the gamma matrix you need is a 2x2 gamma matrix, and there's no gamma 5.
Mm-hmm.
There's no additional gamma matrix that anti-commute with all this. That's a general property in odd space-time dimension. All right, so so translation does this, which is just saying the phi plus, phi minus have different momentum, so they get different phase. That's already enough to rule out this guy. Right, so, I haven't finished explaining why this, I call it a mass. Because if you diagonize this, you get what? You get delta x squared plus delta y squared. I mean, there's a velocity, doesn't matter. Let's put in the velocity. Plus m squared. This will be the eigenvalue you get. And at delta k equal to 0, there will still be a gap of 2m between the upper and lower level. So essentially you no longer have this, rather you have this. Yes?
So previously you worked on the Hamiltonian without the mass term, and now you're talking about it with the mass term. Are we trying to show that that's not relevant here?
No. I'm saying if you have such a term, That will be a mass. That will open up a gap for your car.
Mass is what's gonna
separate
the bands.
Yes. If you have that term.
Are we modeling, like you mentioned that this gap will open, for example, if you have more than nearest neighbors. So are we wanting?
No. I'm asking if that will happen if I have more than nearest neighbor.
Okay, and are we?
I'll say that it's not gonna happen.
Are we modeling that by introducing a mass term?
Yes.
Okay.
So Yeah. I should also say that. So in general, you add the term on the lattice. But now, if we just focus on low energy states near the Dirac cone, that will behave as a term, additional term in my Dirac Hamiltonian.
Okay.
But why don't you just have, like, similar to how having, how we had t, we have just t prime and t, t double prime and stuff like that.
Sorry, what's t?
See how having a mass term is same as having more neighbors, or more neighbors.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm asking the question, if having more neighbor terms will somehow give you a mass term. Let's say if I have a term on the lattice, let's say some ci dagger ci prime, let's say some
rather bit bigger, yeah. Cannot say
clear. Oh, sorry.
Light.
So I prime is some, I don't know, second neighbor, third neighbor, something, right? Suppose I have this term. I can always rewrite this term in the Fourier space. And then becomes some term in the in CK dagger CK. And now I focus that term on momentum near K and K prime, essentially on such states. And that will behave as some additional term in my Dirac Hamiltonian. Okay. So that's the, yeah, I should be more clear about the strategy there. Right? So it will be some term. The question is, what are those terms? Can they be mass terms? And they can do other things. They can shift the chemical potential a little bit. They can move my Dirac point a little bit. But can they open up a gap?
What is tau x1?
Sorry?
What is tau x1?
Tau x1.
Oh, sorry. Meaning I can have tau x or tau y sigma x. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. That was just a lazy shorthand. Yeah. All right, so that rules out. By now it's clear what I mean by this. Such term. Right? Because this operation doesn't commute with this. Right? So I can do an operation that, you know, I can plug this in. For example, this will become, for example, e to the I tau z tau x y sigma z e to the minus I 2 pi over 3 tau z. This is what I get by literally plugging this in. But then you see that because tau z doesn't commute with tau x or tau y, you're going to change this term after the symmetry operation. And that's not allowed if I have translation symmetry.
Can
yes.
You remember how explicitly what the taus are?
Sorry. Remember, tau is acting on this plus minus index, right? This plus means it's k plus delta k. Minus means it's minus k plus delta k.
Yeah, so what exactly does the tau do?
So, for example, tau z acting on this thing equal to k plus delta. Minus k plus delta k. Because tau z is something like 1 minus 1. Right? So if it's tau x, I'm going to exchange this two. Right? If it's tau y, I'm going to exchange this two, but there's a minus sign. There's an I in one place, minus I in the other place.
Why don't you just have sigma matrices then?
Yeah, I've already used sigma for A and B.
It is the same thing.
They're all Pauli matrices. We just need more letters to represent Pauli matrices. Yeah. Right? So, but in hindsight, I didn't have to do that. You just read off, just look at what tau x, tau y does. As I said, okay, if I do have tau x, that means I'm exchanging the plus k and minus k, right? So if I really write down the component, for example, right? Right, if I look at, forget about sigma x for a moment. So what does this term do? Well, if you expand it out, right, this is gonna be something like psi plus dagger psi minus plus psi minus dagger psi plus. Okay. What does it mean? It means that you take a fermion mode at momentum minus k, you return with a fermion mode at plus k. That violates momentum conservation. You don't do that, right? So remember, in the Hamiltonian, it's always c dagger k, c k. You never have c dagger k, c some k prime, right? Because you have translation symmetry. Now this term violates translation symmetry, right? This is just a formal way to see that. So this term is ruled out. Okay, so we have two other terms to think about. Can we have those terms? Now, you can see that those terms either doesn't involve tau or just involves a tau z. So that's compatible, that they commute with the translation operator, because the translation operator only involves tau z. So they're okay with translation. But now let's look at another symmetry, which is space inversion. Let me also sometimes call it C2. So in two dimension, a space inversion is just a 120-degree rotation. Sorry, 180-degree rotation. You invert both x and y. Okay. But in this case, let me specifically mean that, I mean, there's some choice of which point I'm rotating around or inverting around. So in this case, I'm choosing this point. You can see that if I invert my entire space, the x and y component, with respect to this point, the entire lattice doesn't change. You can similarly choose this point. It doesn't really hurt. Okay. So now if I do that, you can ask, what does it do, right? Well, we see that it exchanges A and B sublattice, right? That's clear. Well, the other thing is they exchange, they invert momentum, right? That's what space inversion does. High rotation. So k becomes minus k as well. Yes. So remember k and minus k, they're opposite of each other. So they get a change under inversion. So what that means is psi plus x becomes sigma x psi minus sigma x psi plus minus x. So this minus x is just inverting the space coordinate. Okay. So remember, I'm exchanging plus minus index here. I'm also putting a sigma x because I'm exchanging a and b sublattice index. Okay. But now, in the Pauli matrix spaces, that's just sigma x tau x psi minus x. Okay. Sorry, in case you got confused, when I write this, I always meant the tensor product of the two Pauli matrices, in case that's what you've been confused about. And now you can see that this operation doesn't commute with the sigma z. Because if you do this, sigma x anti-commutes with sigma z. So if you take this term and perform this operation, this thing gets a minus sign. But this tau z sigma z is okay, because tau z anti-commutes with tau x, sigma z anti-commutes with sigma x, so they end up actually commuting. So this is not ruled out by the inversion search. Yes?
Sir, I have another fundamental question. So you are saying that these three possibilities are the only possibility for a mass term?
Yes.
So what's the...
So you can try to list out, you can play with, let's say, tau z sigma x or other stuff, and then you realize that they will commute with one of those kinetic terms.
So I think the mass term must commute with the other.
The mass term has to commute, has to anti-commute with all the kinetic terms.
So why anti-commute instead of commutes?
Oh, if it commutes, it just shifts things around. You can actually try to diagonalize the Hamiltonian,
uh-huh.
See what happens. It doesn't get you this kind of structure.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, this kind of structure, which is what I mean by a gap, requires anti-commute. By the way, actually, let me make sure. Have you seen things like this in your QFT class? Like Dirac equation, masses being anti-commuting with each other? Okay. Yeah, just make sure I'm not. All right. So that's another term that's forbidden. And in fact, if you allow the breaking of inversion symmetry, indeed, you can now add this term. And then the Dirac fermion is getting gapped. And there is a real system that does that. That's known as the hexagonal boron nitride. Actually, the monolayer version of that. So it's a close relative of graphene. It almost looks like graphene, except it also gets you a honeycomb lattice. Except on every A site, you have a nitride, and on every B site, you have a boron. That's the only difference. Otherwise, it looks pretty much like graphene. Well, the only difference between this and graphene is that it doesn't have inversion symmetry. Now, if you try to invert, well, this is a boron, this is a nitride, they're not the same. Right. So. And in fact, if you take an actual single layer of boron nitride, which experimentalists know how to do, it's a good semiconductor. You don't get massless Dirac fermion. You get stuff like, you know, like that. Right? It's actually a pretty good semiconductor. And the beauty is, to know that much, you don't even actually need to solve the Hamiltonian again. You just say, okay, it doesn't have inversion symmetry, done. Right, because of this analysis. Of course, you can actually solve the Hamiltonian. But essentially, the term that plays this role is also actually very simple. It's just a staggered chemical potential, meaning I add a delta mu, which takes C dagger, the boron site, for example, minus the nitrogen site. Right. I just add this term on the same side. Right. Into the nearest neighbor type binding model, and it will do the job. At low energy, you can see that it actually behaves like this, and it opens a gap for you.
Can you go over how it opens a gap? Because that's not very.
You mean how does this term open a gap? So to see this, you actually solve the Hamiltonian,
yeah.
But which is not that hard to solve, because what does this do? First of all, it's an on-site term, right? So meaning it doesn't have any k dependence. If you do Fourier transform, it's going to be a constant for k. And we know that it says in terms of sublattice A and B, it's a C dagger A C A minus C dagger B C B. So that's a poly sigma Z matrix. So what happens is that you literally add this term because it's a sigma z. Yeah. Yeah.
And because once you get that term, how do you see that this opens up a gap? Because it is one of the mass terms, that's what?
Yeah. Because you can see that it anti-commutes with a kinetic term. And then you diagonalize it, you see that the spectrum is plus minus square root of the sum, which is never vanishing.
How would you experimentally, what is the significance of the relative minus sign? You need it to get the sigma z, but I don't understand,
Because if it's plus sign, it doesn't break inversion symmetry.
Right,
And so what does that mean physically for the actual system?
Oh, if it's plus, it means it's an overall chemical potential. You just shift your, for example, you dope it. Or you, you know, for graphene, they can, you know, gate it, turn on a voltage, and then you get density away from hot filling. They do that all the time, right? Or you get a Fermi surface, but you don't kill the Dirac cone. Yeah. All right, so that's inversion. Now, I haven't told you why there's a yet another term, that's a tau z sigma z. That one is not killed by anything yet. Right, so why can't I add that term? To understand that, you understand you look at time reversal symmetry. Actually, let me make sure. Have you seen time reversal symmetry in your quantum mechanics class? You do? OK, good. So so this is anti-unitary, unlike any other symmetry we talk about. So you have to be a little bit more careful. Yes?
Actually, I think a lot of us haven't seen time reversal symmetry.
Oh, you haven't? OK, good. it's OK. I'll define it for you anyway. Yeah, I'll define it for you anyway. Good. Well, OK. So a crash course is, let me. Crash course. You want something that inverts time. But if you really do that, your unitary time evolution operator, it looks like it gets inverted. So it almost looks like you're inverting Hamiltonian. But we don't like doing that because if Hamiltonian is nicer when it's at least bounded below. If you do this, it becomes bounded above, and then it becomes weird. So the better thing to do, if you want to keep the structure of this while inverting time, is to say I goes to minus I. Right? And that's called anti-unitary. So unitary symmetry doesn't, a unitary operator never does that. I is constant. But anti-unitary takes I to minus I. But otherwise, it behaves like an ordinary symmetry. Right? For example, in the ordinary case, x is still x. Because I'm just inverting time, I'm not inverting space. But that does mean that momentum becomes minus momentum, which makes sense. If I'm inverting time, momentum should, velocity should also invert, which you can see by noting that momentum is I partial x. So if I'm not inverting x, but I'm inverting I, this thing should go to the opposite. That's basically time reversal. It gets more complicated for a spin half and so on, but let's not get there. We don't need that. Okay, so time reversal, as I said, it's I goes to minus I, meaning it's anti-unitary. Now let's ask what does it do on my Dirac fermion? Okay, so as I said, psi up plus psi minus, because I'm inverting momentum. Remember the psi plus and psi minus live at opposite momentum. So they should get inverted. But other than that, it's, there's nothing weird about it, right? Because it only inverts time, it doesn't invert space. So sigma, the sublattice structure, doesn't get changed, right? A remains A, B remains B. So which means it just does this. And you can actually check that this is actually a symmetry of that Dirac Hamiltonian, right? Because what is that Dirac Hamiltonian? That Dirac Hamiltonian looks like psi dagger tau z sigma x I partial x plus sigma y I partial y psi. So if I multiply psi by tau x, psi dagger by tau x dagger, which is also tau x, then you see that it commutes with this term, but it anti-commutes with this term. So that matrix multiplication will get you a minus sign here, but not here. But you say, wait a minute, there's an I here. Then that gets you another minus sign, so they cancel. You say, well, wait a minute, there's an I here. So that gives you a minus sign. But sigma y is complex, it's imaginary. Sigma y is something like minus ii in the off diagonal. So that also gets a minus I because time reversal flips I. So every term gets two minus I, they cancel. Right? That's how it becomes a symmetry. Okay? So now this is a symmetry and we can talk about it. Let's see what does it do. Immediately you see that it anti-commutes with that tau z sigma z because of this tau x. No, tau z sigma z is purely real, so you don't have to worry about I goes to minus I stuff. But tau x does anti-commute with tau z. So it's, it gets inverted on the transverse. So we're basically done. All the possible mass terms you can imagine writing down are forbidden by some kind of symmetry. Okay? But I should say this is what we call a perturbative argument. This is saying if I imagine turning on a little bit of other term, like a little bit of second neighbor hopping, a little bit of third neighbor hopping, what can happen? Because if it's just a little bit, then I can, you know, still only consider my fermions near the Dirac point. If it's a lot, I'm starting to touch, you know, things like this part of the band structure and so on, and then it becomes harder to tell. Right? So in fact, there is such an example. That is, so I used the C2 inversion symmetry, translation and time reversal. One thing I haven't used is the C3, the 120 degree rotation. Right, let's say I take this point and I do a 2 pi over 3 rotation. The lattice remains the same. So that's C3. I haven't used that. It turns out if you break C3 a little bit, the Dirac fermion is still there, right? Because you don't need that symmetry to rule out all the mass term. But if you break it a lot, you kill the Dirac fermion, right? The reason is actually also quite simple, because if I draw the Brillouin zone, k prime, there is something special about k and k prime. I say, okay, of course they are special. They are at zone corner. Well, that's nothing special because the notion of zone corner is basis dependent. They are special in the sense that if I take this momentum k and I rotate by 2 pi over 3, what do I get? I get here. I get here. But which is also k. They're related by a reciprocal lattice vector. Likewise for k prime. So k and k prime, beside this center momentum, which sometimes called gamma, that's zero momentum. So these three momentum points are the only C3 invariant momentum points. Okay? So which means as long as I preserve the C3 rotation symmetry, I cannot move the Dirac cone from here to somewhere here. Right? Let's say you can ask, what's special about K, right? Can I have a Hamiltonian that realizes Dirac cone but somewhere in a different momentum? Can't do that because after a C3 rotation, it goes to somewhere here, but this is not the same, they're not the same momentum. So you need more Dirac cones to preserve C3. So if you only have two Dirac cones, one at K and one K prime, you can't move it. Okay? And that's why if you break C3 a little bit, what happens is that this Dirac cones start to move. They're still there. You can't open up a gap and kill them, but they're still there. What could happen is the Dirac point at here moved a little bit to here. And this guy moved from K prime to a little bit here. And if you keep moving stuff, eventually these two will meet. Now they can kill each other just by hybridizing, just by some Hamiltonian. Essentially by the tau x sigma x or tau y sigma y there. Because now they are at the same momentum. Coupling between them doesn't break translation symmetry anymore. So then you get an insulator. So breaking C3 a little bit doesn't hurt, but breaking it a lot gets you an insulator. And that insulator is actually quite simple. What is that insulator? Well, that insulator is this. So now back in real space, instead of having now take the nearest neighbor tight binding model, but instead you call this bond T, but this bond T prime. it's still a nearest neighbor type binding model. You can solve it. What you will see is that if t is if t is much larger than t prime, you can actually solve the Hamiltonian quite simply, because if you only have t, the ground state is where you have an orbit that mixes between these two. Essentially, the eigenstate will be a CA dagger plus CB dagger, A and B, just an equal superposition. That will be eigenstate. And then you just get it, essentially you just get, you know, every orbit on this side filled. And turning on a little bit of T prime hopping that won't change the nature of the insulator. Right. But if T is only a little bit larger than T prime, you get the Dirac cones. Yeah, and one last thing that I will mention, I won't actually have time to go through, is that there is actually an even stronger non-perturbative argument for graphene. That is, you just take the lattice, take all the symmetries, C3, C2, translation, time reversal. Turns out you can argue without solving any Hamiltonian that at k and k prime, the two bands have to touch. You have to get something like Dirac Fermi. But that argument is a little bit more sophisticated, so let me not actually get into. But if you are interested, feel free to try it. It's actually quite a bit of fun. So that's for it today. So tomorrow, I'll switch gear to talk about transport in metal. So why are metals metallic, essentially?
Not tomorrow, Thursday.
Thursday, yes.